Welcome to our second talk on the book of Hebrews. The first talk looked at the broad context of Hebrews, and we put forward the strong claim that Hebrews was written by Apollos, not by Paul. I think nobody today doubts that. That wasn't the important part about that talk. What we talked about there was that there's a fresh voice in Hebrews, a voice coming from Alexandria, a voice not tied to the Jerusalem headquarters of the early church. And because of that, the thinking in Hebrews could push the gospel as far or even further than anyone in the New Testament did. So this talk gets into the book itself, and we look at the first two chapters. And these chapters are absolutely epic. They set the tone for the entire book. They revolve around Psalm 8 and put forward a magnificently human-centered view of Jesus and his divinity. They collect and bind together in a great partnership Jesus Christ, who, the writer says in the first verses, made the universe with his brethren, us human beings. And from that very, very high prominent tree, the book proceeds. So tonight's all about chapters 1 and 2. We do begin looking at the overall structure of the book, because to understand the opening, it makes a lot more sense if you can put it in the overall structure. So there's a lot in tonight. It's the beginning of a great journey. Enjoy it. Okay. We're now getting into the guts of Hebrews. The first talk, who was here for the first talk? Did I just show of hands? About half. Well, I'm not going to go through it again, but you heard it. Yeah, heard it go. Yeah, it's quite exciting. I mean, I'm certainly charting new horizons for myself in this as well. It's a great irony in Hebrews, as I said there. It's a very long book, but it's quite esoteric for 20th century readers in the Western world. Its arguments are all built upon a sophisticated dialogue with the Jewish community. And so I spent time last time really trying to modernise the problems of Hebrews, because I've actually found this book, It's of all books in the New Testament, the one I've journeyed with the longest, and in a way spoken to me the most. So recalling the problems that Hebrews was addressing, we spent a long time talking about the Judaizing of the gospel, which essentially was, we looked at the way that the Jewish church, not the Jewish antagonists, but the James, the headquarters of the early believers, definitely in Jerusalem, definitely the policymakers, they were sucking the gospel back into a religious framework. That's actually what was happening. One foot in, one foot out. And now what that meant in practice, this is really important for us, that was sucking them back into a sacrificial system. You couldn't really participate in Jewish customs without essentially re-sacrificing. That was the heart of the temple. Now, what that was leading to, and one can imagine it happening over time, and I think the writer to the Hebrews, whom I argued was Apollos, had a prophetic, strategic interpretation of what was happening, which was everything was up for grabs. And the great danger was an implicit downgrading of the role of Jesus versus the role of Moses. So Moses was the archetype, the paradigm, and the danger was that the role of Jesus was getting diminished in many ways. Now, the only way out of that, which is what this book's going to talk about, and this is really important, is a radical repositioning of the gospel outside the entire category of religion. It's not even in the category. He's not inside a religious box arguing in the religious box Jesus started the best religion in the world. His vision of reality is cosmic, and that's where he's going to establish his argument.
This is what a great arguer does, a great thinker does. They have a very big picture. They take you out of a small picture, they put you into a big picture. So he's going to position Jesus in cosmic and creational terms. And in that area, Jesus, in his mind, is the undisputed ruler. That's where Jesus rules. Now, the effect of this is he doesn't rule the religious domain. He begins to use words in the latter, we won't get them tonight, words in the latter part of Hebrews that trash religion. So that's where I talked about last time. He was contextually unable to go where Paul did not go in his life. In my view, as we talked about last time, Paul was exhausted by his battle with Jerusalem, and the last eight chapters of Acts are the exhausted, ultimately failed attempts of a wonderful man. And someone else had to pick the baton up and carry the message forward, and I believe it was Apollos. Nothing wrong with that. I think it's fantastic because that's how God works. You know, it relieves us of the Superman. I think we've made Paul too much of a Superman, as if there was no one else. I mean, I'm definitely speculating. We've got the book of Hebrews. What else do we have? What a bench strength there was in this New Testament church, because this is definitely equal to Paul in intellect and theological vision. But Paul actually had kind of disqualified himself to take the gospel to the next step. We all do that in life. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, so it's a really important, I found that personally, a really liberating idea. God's bigger than me. He's got a team. You know, there's delegation and succession that happens. And in a way, it's a succession plan. So Jesus doesn't rule the religious domain. And furthermore, this is where the language of the latter part of Hebrews is unthinkable. For those of you who heard the talk, you know, Paul on the steps of the temple at Jerusalem, to actually imagine the antagonists they were up against, you've got to think modern jihadists. These were the fundamentalists for whom it was quite within their religion to murder Paul. You know, we went through that section, how many young men who'd made a vow to God, that they would not eat again, I don't know if they starved themselves to death because it didn't happen, until they'd killed Paul. This was their religious duty to murder Paul. I mean, this is the scary stuff we've got with, you know, Islamic State stuff. I mean, frankly, that's what they're up against. This was very scary people. Now, imagine the latter, when you get to the verses, the word he uses and the whole pact with Paul was James and the elders, you know, pleaded with him to show that he kept the customs of Moses, And he did, to show he kept the custom of Moses. But Apollos will argue the law is obsolete. That's the word he uses. It's absolutely failed and finished and obsolete and junk. It's junk. Throw it away. That's what you'll get in Hebrews 7, 8 and 9. I mean, language that's unthinkable. I just imagine him standing on the steps of the temple reading that out. He would have been torn to pieces. But clearly he was free of those shackles and a courageous man. So Jesus is beyond the domain of religion. Why? Because religion did not achieve its purpose. He's a great rhetorician. I argue everything back to its purpose. If something does not achieve its purpose, it's junk. And that's what his argument will be. So that's, I hope, gives you a sense of the breathtaking vision of this man. We went through stuff which I won't go through again, which our modern version of this, where we find it very difficult to move the gospel out of a Sunday, Monday kind of schizophrenia. And we looked at Bonhoeffer and the language when he was in prison of religion. His phrase was religionless Christianity. And he was struggling for language that didn't seem religious. You know, we talked about the fact that he didn't really see God. We put God to the, by making him religious, we put him to the edges of life. He's the problem solver of your sins. But what's he got to do with the central cause of life? Nothing. And we need a God who dominates the central cause. This is where Bonhoeffer's mind was going. By the way, I need to correct one error. I said he came from a non-Christian family. Not entirely true. His mother was a woman of faith. His father was an agnostic, but they were very broad-minded people. I thought I should clarify that. So where he was going to was a humanism, Bonhoeffer. You know, it's actually, we need the language of the human, not the Christian. This, and of course, those of us who've heard Edwin Judge, actually, Edwin, Edwin won't call himself a Christian because historically it was a term of abuse. It was not a term the Christians chose. They didn't choose it for themselves. Part of the difficulty, part of their genius was they were not named. And so, you know, you couldn't sort of find an address. You couldn't, they were viral. And they were called all sorts of different things. They defined themselves by Christ. So, and certainly a point that Edwin has made to me repeatedly is that the opponents didn't see Christianity as a religion. The Roman philosophers and writers did not ever categorise it as a religion for about 400 years. They categorised it as a philosophy because it made such big claims about life. It wasn't really about rituals. Of course, what Bonhoeffer was trying to do was he himself was struggling to find alternative language. Well, what would church look like if I didn't use religious language? You know, what would gospel look like if I didn't use religious language? And tonight, part of the ambition, I'm going to try to address that. For me, it's not hard because my life is lived in practice and has been for decades outside the boundaries of religious life. And I found the most relevant and interesting areas of my life have seamless. I can't personally in my mind draw any boundaries between Sunday and Monday, and I haven't for two decades. Like, I can't even remember what that felt like. But finding a more structured way of explaining that to people is rather hard, if that makes sense to you. Tonight I'm going to make another attempt to do that. We've done that before. Where I try to sort of pick up Bonhoeffer's challenge of, well, what would it be like if we talked about this stuff without using religious language? Now, I want to say something here that definitely, I haven't got a Bonhoeffer quote. He saw this, though. At face value, a lot of people, a lot of evangelical Christians are very, very wary of where Bonhoeffer went, and guy like Metaxas, who wrote, he's a pretty conservative evangelical, wrote the big book on Bonhoeffer. He's scared of this stuff, to be blunt. Can't handle it, can't understand it. I didn't really mean that, he meant this. You know, that's how he handles it. Because it looks liberal. It looks like I'm lowering the battleground territory and I'm becoming a relativist. If I participate freely in the broad panoramas of life as a human being, that sounds like I'm now a humanist and I'm a wishy-washy liberal. A lot of people feel that. Actually, the opposite's the case, and Bonhoeffer knew it, because the backflow of me claiming that Jesus is the Lord of the cosmos and utterly human is he's actually relevant. There's nowhere I can exclude his lordship from. It's actually a more radical claim for lordship. I'm not actually confining Jesus to the ghetto of the church. Sorry, he rules the cosmos, which means politics, which means the environment, which means technology, which means absolutely every human endeavour is the temple of God. Now, if you haven't got the imagination to see that, then that's what we need to grow into. So, actually, it's a far more radical claim of the rule, of the lordship of Jesus than anyone has ever, could make. But it's a claim that will have to be I suppose, developed in a way that is nuanced and clever. Certainly raises broader questions than I can raise tonight, which is what's my participation with people who are not Christians in that sphere, and so on. So that's where we got to last time. I'll go through that one. So let's now go to Hebrews. And we're going into the text. And what I'm going to try to do tonight is span two worlds with you. One is actually, I'm going to look at Hebrews in a semi-orthodox way, by which I mean as Bible study, you know, textual study, doctrinal, theological. But I'm going to do it in a way, because I think the actual message, when properly understood, is a trajectory out of theological language, out of the kind of the religious box into a broader box. So we're going to do that, but then I'm going to do almost a reinterpretation of the message in far broader terms that are philosophical, I'm going to talk philosophy, I'm going to talk linguistics, I'm going to talk design, I'm going to talk technology, I'm going to talk marketplaces, right? And virtually I'm going to give you the same message, just rewired into the whole world of modern life that I participate in. It's not the whole world, but the world that I participate in. So it's kind of like do Hebrews as a Bible study, run the same message using non-religious language. Does that make sense? Okay, now, so let's get back to Hebrews. Sarah took us through the literary techniques of understanding text. When you've got a big text, could be a novel, could be a Shakespeare play, one of the critical capabilities is to oscillate between big picture and little picture. You know, broad sweep and themes and structure of the narrative, then down to a detail. It's incredibly important in the Bible, and very few people do it. My favourite's the Book of Job, and it's the motto of Abbotsley. I forget what it is, something about, because the time flies like a... Yeah. What is it again, Nikki? Time flies faster than the weaver's shuttle. Now, we're meant... from the Bible, a axiomatically true phrase. And that phrase actually was not spoken by either God or Job, but by Job's false comforters. They said that, and the text actually probably says this could be absolute crap, you know, but it's what people think. You see what I mean? So if I actually go to a big picture, I'm not going to do it tonight, but I actually might say that is satirical, as an example, in the context. So I'm not particularly worried about that, but it's really important in Hebrews, because Hebrews has got such a thicket of arguments that if you get down to the level of clauses and sentences, they're just packed with stuff. And if you take out a single verse, it can do a lot of damage. And as I've said before, the critical verses, which you'll see in a moment in Hebrews, are actually the scariest verses in the New Testament, which a lot of Christians survive by never having read them. But having read them, they really, you know, absolutely scare you. And they scared me for years and years as a young Christian, because unfortunately I read my Bible and I'm a literary guy, so I take notice of the words. And that's chapter 6. In chapter 6, it says, look, let's not lay again the foundation of blah, 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 repentance and so on and so on. For it is impossible for those who were once enlightened and have tasted the Holy Spirit and the Word of God, etc., if they should fall away, to renew them again to repentance, because they would be crucifying the Son of God afresh and putting him to an open shame. Scary verses. They seem to say, if you ever give this faith up, apostate, you cannot get back. It's impossible to renew you again to repentance. That tormented me. I thought, I used to, as a young 17-year-old Christian, well, what if I'm being tortured and I give it up? It means there's no way back. I mean, and then, of course, everything starts to collapse. Like, where's promise, where's grace fitting into this? You know, it's very difficult. Now, if you look at the NIV, the big NIV Bible commentary, it gives you three possible interpretations of that. And they're the traditional three, and they're all wrong. So in No Way Out, I'm a young Christian reading that thinking, they weren't actually really Christians. They just tasted the Word of God. They weren't really rigid Christians. You know, that's one of the three. And you're trying to squirm our way out of that. So as I've told people, I'm not going to give you the meaning of it tonight. I'll let you work it out yourself if you want to, but it's going to come in talks 3 or 4, depending. but the meaning, actually, when I got it, I just got it in my own kind of meditation and just became obvious it means almost exactly the opposite of what I thought it meant. And it's so obvious when I saw it that it took me like several years for it to dawn on me what it was saying. But then it's almost like a key that unlocks everything else. So let me give you the big picture, really helpful. So the big picture is the opening two chapters are like the corridor or the entrance door to his argument against the Judaizing of the gospel. And that opening is dominated by Psalm 8. This is really important. This opening is, I think, the most majestic two chapters in the New Testament. I mean, it's either that or Romans 8. But Romans 8, I'm not the only one who puts Romans 8 and Hebrews 2 together. Hebrews 2 is critically unique in the New Testament. Middleton makes that point in his book on the New Heaven and the New Earth. It has a unique use of prophecy, which I'll come to tonight. No one does what he's doing. And if we get that message, that begins to unlock the door Bonhoeffer wanted to get unlocked, to away from Christian to human. Because he re-specifies humanity. That's what he does. As defined by Christ. It's in fact what he does in chapter 2. So he opens up like any great rhetorician by, in a sense, lifting the argument to a level that's unexpected. If, for instance, you or I were confronted with the problems we talked about of Judaizing of the gospel, we would probably try and hit it head on with an argument that it's actually, no, it's not religious, it's this, it's not sacrificial, it's this, the problem with... And what we would find, the minute... I used to be a debater, so I understand this very well. If you address your problem head on, you get sucked into being nothing but a reflection of your problem. Does that make sense? That's why right-wing and left-wing in politics are just the same. And that's why there are strange alliances in history between extreme right-wing and extreme left-wing. Why? Because they're actually the same thing. They're using the same terms. They're fundamentalists. The left or right is just a flexion point of a fundamentalist mindset. So by saying I'm extreme left or extreme right, I'm not doing anything. I'm just a fundamentalist. You see what I mean? So to be smart, I've got to lift this debate to a higher level. That's what he does. He actually does not enter the debate. Now, this is absolutely critical because what that means in practice is he does not define the problem as sin. In chapters 1 and 2, he simply doesn't. So that's his opening, and it's epic, and that's where we'll go tonight. What he then does, and this is really important because you'll find in this magnificent book, like a great poem or a great play you might study, reverberations of key phrases. And this one is a biggie that actually gets very much to what we might take home with us tonight. Fix your ideas on Jesus. That's how he finishes this epic 1 and 2. Let him dominate your imagination, redefine your thoughts, redefine your self-image. The phrase is fix your thoughts, your idea structure, how you interpret the world on Jesus. Not on the religion, not on the codes, not on the practices, on the person. Does that make sense? I think about that when I look in the mirror, you know, and I'm getting older and wrinkly. I think, this is defining me. No, actually the truth about who you are, you better think about Jesus. You will actually distort your image of who you are if you actually look at yourself. You'll get it wrong. It occurred to me once, I thought it was a verse in the Bible, but it isn't, but I wish it was. So anyway, it's the verse I'll put back in the Bible, which is just this. The truth about who you are does not lie inside yourself. The truth about who you are does not lie inside yourself. It lies outside of yourself in Christ. That's what he says. What he then does after that is he then moves into what I would call a negative argument. And he spends chapters 3, 4, and 5 as a negative comparison. And he proves the superiority of Jesus in order over Moses, Joshua, and Aaron. 3, 4, and 5. They kind of roughly, they each get their own chapter. But the whole Mosaic system that Moses began, Jesus is superior to that. And that's his kind of, you know, that's a very good way of sort of summarizing what happens in those chapters and their arguments. He then comes to the chapter 6, which is the hinge. It is the hinge of the book. And for those of you who'd listened to Sarah's talk, this is, to me, unarguably a massive chiastic structure where the middle starts to hinge everything. And he ends chapter 5, which we'll get to, is I want to go on and talk to you about the positives. That's actually how chapter 5, but you couldn't understand it if I told you about it. Now, what he means, if you look at it carefully, you don't have the conceptual structures in your mind to get it. It's like talking to a child about sex. You know, well, I must say, our little 7-8-year-old Finn was magnificent on sex the other night. Coming to the funeral, this is an interesting story. He's coming to my dear mum's funeral because my Sarah was just so upset about mum's passing. And we are kids, they don't have a sense of timing. And I don't know how it brewed up, but Edie, his 6-year-old sister, came up with what's sex on the way to the funeral. I don't need to get into this now. But luckily, Finn, who's an 8 going on 80, jumped in with Private Parts Unite. Edie, Private Parts Unite. At the age of 8, so they... Oh, I wonder where he learned that. So perhaps kids know more than we think. But anyway, I like that example because no matter what language passes to a certain age, it doesn't get into a conceptual structure. And we like that about a lot of stuff. So people don't understand that, a lot of us don't understand that to understand anything requires a conceptual framework. If you try to explain to me some things like quantum mechanics, I don't have the conceptual frameworks to get what you're even talking about. And that's what he says. I'd like to go on, but you can't understand it. Because you're revolving, you're kind of like hog-tied. You're like the dog who's hog-tied and keeps running around and around and around. You can't break out. So what he wants to talk about is the resurrection and how the resurrection has changed everything. And his great archetype of the resurrection is Melchizedek, the new priesthood. And then chapters 7, 8, and 9 are dominated by Abraham, not Moses. He begins the great flexion point. He goes to Abraham. Now, you've heard Mark Strom say, and I think it's a really penetrating point, that he cannot find any positive thing, Paul says, about Moses in his epistles. He doesn't criticize him, but he doesn't use Moses as some kind of archetype. He uses Abraham. So this is another case, I think, of course, Apollos was not Paul, but I think he was definitely influenced by Paul. His archetype's Abraham. And the new priesthood is the Melchizedekian priesthood. And what starts to dominate the latter part is an amplification of what the new order will look like. Then, the climax is the telos, the end of all things, which is chapters 10 and 11 and 12, where he talks about Mount Zion, the new Jerusalem, the city of the living God. And it's a phenomenal kind of coda of the whole book. But again, this echo, as you'll know, very famously, chapter 12, fix your eyes on Jesus. So beginning and end of the argument is Jesus redefines everything as bookend. So that's Hebrews on a page. Does that help? You can go then inside that. You will then find the modules inside that support those themes. And we'll do that. But tonight, it's just the first one. Now, another way of organising a literary piece is not structure, which is what we've got here, but metaphors. Great writers, great speech makers use evocative language. And whilst there might be, I don't know how many words there are in the book of Hebrews, hundreds and hundreds of them, clearly some of them are carrying a lot of weight, like a metaphor. And the metaphor is, there are six, at least, there are several of them in Hebrews, but here are six big ones, and some of them are extremely important. So, another way of studying Hebrews would be to look at how these words play out through the theme of the book. I'm not going to go into it now, but the first one is, let me just ask you the question. Here it is. I love these quizzes. I gave it to John Dixon. John failed. So the question is, what appellation or role or description of the office of Jesus do we have in Hebrews that occurs nowhere else in the New Testament epistles? What office of Jesus, role of Jesus do we have in Hebrews? Highly developed, by the way, not just kind of mentioned. Sorry? No. Interesting to see if that does, but I think Peter does certainly develop that one. I'm not sure, but anyway, it's not that one I'm thinking of. Well done. That is it. Unique in the New Testament, and we'll see it tonight, they are my brothers. Sorry, it's not unique in the New Testament. It's unique in the New Testament epistles. Paul doesn't mention it. Peter doesn't mention it. John, what does John say?
I called you servants, but now
It's friends. Friends. But where it is mentioned, you're on the right track, is in the Gospels at the resurrection. And Jesus uses the words. When Jesus rises from the dead, remember what he says to him? Go and tell my brethren. So that's where he uses it. But the only New Testament writer that picks up and makes a big deal of it is Apollos. The other one, this is really important. These are the first two are the most important. Made perfect, as applied to Jesus. Not to us, but to Jesus. It's I don't know, perhaps it's four times in Hebrews. What's this about? He's the Son of God. He's God. He's perfect. How is he made perfect? Very important questions. Unique, not used elsewhere. No one else uses this. So he's got some picture in his mind. This guy has got a conceptual structure that other people don't have. Now, the word in the Greek is really important. There are several words translated perfect in the New Testament, but this one is teleosis, and you'll see in it, it's got telos in the middle of it. It is something to do with maturing to the end game. Not kind of moral perfection, it's like a fulfillment or consummation of all potential, might be a way to put it. Achieving the fulfillment of all your potential. That's the actual word. We know about Melchizedek. Very important is house of God, city of God. Won't go into that. Other parts of the New Testament use this, but very important here. Very important the concept of an order, like a paradigm and a framework. He uses that a lot. And the last one is extremely important, but it's also used by Paul a great deal, inheritance. Okay, so I just thought I'd give you those because they're things that you might find useful. Let's go into Hebrews 1 and do exactly the same now. I'm now going to go into Hebrews 1, looking at it from the textual doctrinal point of view. And the point, I think, about Hebrews 1 and 2 is looking at it theologically and doctrinally, is it lays the foundation. It gives, let me just say this, properly read, it gives authority and a mandate to all that Bonhoeffer was struggling towards. That's how I'd put it. His theological arguments give a mandate theologically to what Bonhoeffer was struggling for. Ron, would you open the door? I think they haven't got the air conditioning. I'm a bit warm, I don't know anyone else. So that's second point is that it isn't just it gives a theological mandate, it gives us trajectories of thought as to the kind of theology we ought to have to allow us to have a bigger picture. So the structure is, it opens, as I said, with I didn't say this before. Verses 1 to 4, he goes right back to the beginning. Creation and its purpose. That's where it all begins. He doesn't begin his argument with anything to do with sin, anything to do with sacrifice, nothing. It is creation. And it is not just that, but he centers Christ exactly like Paul does in Colossians, which, by the way, was written after Acts 28 when he was in Rome. I wonder if he'd kind of finally got free enough of Rome to kind of really let the cat out of the bag. But, you know, through whom he made the universe. Just like an adjectival phrase, like through whom he made the universe. It's just mind reverberating in what on earth they saw out of it. He then goes for the rest of chapter 1 into a comparison that actually for a long while meant no sense to me, which is the Son is superior to the angels. Now when I read that, for a long while, Hebrews chapter 1 to me seemed such an archaic, twisted argument, I just couldn't get my head around it, because if you're going to tell me that the Son of God is superior to the angels, I must have a proposition that the angels are superior to the Son of God. Whoever thought that? Whoever thought the angels were better than God? So where's this guy coming from? What's he, you know, so I was immediately knew I wasn't reading it rightly, if you know what I mean. I said, the guy is smart. He's actually responding to something I don't get yet. And we'll come, the answer to that is part of the key. But the quotes, rest of chapter 1 is all quotes from the Old Testament, move on to kingdom, inheritance, and cosmos. So having argued for the epic superiority of Christ, he then goes on with two questions. And it's actually important that we look at the two questions that are a segue into chapter 2. Now, one of them is very famous, which is, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? And that used to be, as I said last time, a scary verse, but it's meant to be a sobering verse, but I don't think it's meant to be a scary verse, which is, like I've just described to you, this epic picture of how the creator of the cosmos has just visited us and repositioned us. So you tell me, if you happen to tell him, screw you, I'm not interested in that message today, I'm reading the Daily Telegraph, will he be cranky? I don't know, work it out yourself. And that's what he does throughout Hebrews. They were called rhetorical questions. He says, I don't know, just work it out yourself, but I wouldn't be in your shoes for quids. And neither would I. I don't think the mechanisms of judgment he gets into, but he certainly says this is a God for whom accountability seems to matter. So given the magnitude of the message, I wouldn't be playing around with it. So he's saying this, what does playing around with it mean? It means, you know, getting sucked into religious custom. So he's not talking about traditional definitions of sin, like debauchery. He's talking about going to mass or going to sacrifices and diminishing the gospels. I wouldn't be doing that for quids. That's the second question. The first question, the first segue, is actually probably the more critical one. The first question he asked. Anyone know what it is? The last verse of Hebrews chapter 1. Are not the angels just ministering spirits or servants sent to serve the Son of God? Correct me. Sent to serve who? Who are they inferior to? Us. Those who will inherit salvation. The segue has moved from the Son to the brethren. So now we look back to his argument that the Son of God is superior to the angels. It's an argument the Son as a human being is superior to the angels. Jesus has located the superiority of humanity over the angels. It's not in his ontological position as divine, which that's given, but as a man, he is superior to the angels. That makes sense? And then he moves on to Psalm 8. So this is really important because, and I've talked about this before, I'm not going to go into it tonight, but it is absolutely developed and amplified in the book of Revelation. Does anyone remember that? Because we've got to get this, because this is going to say that we are paper thin close to God. The book of Revelation has prayers, as we all know, to God. And what I would suggest you do sometime is pull them all out and compare them. There's two authors of the prayers in the book of Revelation. There's human beings, the church, and there's angels. So you pull them all out and you put them side by side and you say, ask yourself the question, are there differences? Like, who seems to have the greatest intimacy with God? Who seems to understand the workings of God, and who seems to be outside of it, a million miles away, looking at the splendor? The answer is, it's the angels who are a million miles away looking at the splendor. There is no intimacy. So this is characterized in the language. The angels only ever use the third person to address God. It's the church has the first and second person. We, you, I, you. There's this intimacy of relationship the church has with God, and only the church gets into creation. Only the church gets into redemption. The rest is just splendor. So it's actually we understand the workings of God. Why? Because we're made in the image of the Son. They're not. They're servants. They won't get it. So this is so question one actually is a segue to which he now takes into Psalm 8. And Psalm 8 is the great kind of revolving point, which I think this is why I've often said to me, chapter 2, Hebrews 2 is, I've always thought, I say it's the most important verse in the New Testament, a chapter in the New Testament, but it's not got many rivals. And the whole point about this second section in chapter 8, which he's going to go into, is that it is going to establish the recovery of rule. And the enemy in Psalm 8 that took rule away was not sin, but death. Death is the enemy, mortality and corruption. Having just participated in my mother's death, we have to understand death is not an event. It's a system. So, yes, Mum died at 2 a.m. on Sunday night and breathed her last. And I had the eerie experience in a modern hospital of watching the monitors chart her death as her pulse went to zero. I could probably have timed the event by the second. But Mum began to die a long time before that. She had dementia, and from a woman who was magnificently capable, she was unable to handle life because she was scared. She was losing faculties. So did I want her, as an example, to just be rescued from death and go back to 1 week prior? No way knowing. She was dying. And when did that begin? Well, arguably, we're all participating in that, and Paul calls it the reign of corruption. We're winding down. That's the problem, and we're losing faculties. So death is a system. It's not an event. And that's the great enemy, not the event. I mean, the event is, yes, but it's the system. And that's the system that Jesus smashed. That's his argument in chapter 8 to regain rule. We'll go into some of the text of this tonight, but I think this big picture is probably as helpful as any for you to dive into the text yourself. But Middleton makes a great deal out of this psalm and the utterly unique use that that Apollos makes of the psalm. When we look at it, you'll see that a shallow reading would say, you know, normally what happens is that the writer takes a New Testament passage and uses that an Old Testament passage to prove the messianic character of Jesus. So the use of the Old Testament prophecy is specifically to amplify Jesus. This is not what he does here. He is doing it to amplify humanity. And amplifying Jesus is a detour to amplify humanity. Middleton makes that point in his book on the new heaven and the new earth. It's quite unique. This is what he's saying. He's quoting the psalm to establish humanity, us, at the core of the cosmos, and Jesus as putting us there. So that's the structure, and you can see there's a nice parallelism in that structure of these magnificent books. Now, the text, obviously, we could spend a lot of time on the text, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time tonight on it, but here's chapter 1, and this magnificent opening, very reminiscent of John, and as I made the point last time, very reminiscent of Philo. God has been, the incredibly powerful point is that God is a communicating God who has used every avenue to communicate to humanity. Prophets, creation, everything to speak to us. But finally, he expressed himself in his most complete form in his Son, the Logos, the Word. Athanasius, whose wonderful book on the Incarnation mirrors Hebrews chapter 1, does exactly the same thing in his great book on the Incarnation. It's Jesus as the Word. Now, what he does, and he, as I said in the introduction, he's going almost right back to the very beginning to establish the purposes of God in the cosmos. And by establishing the purposes of God in the cosmos in chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, the problem he's going to introduce in chapter 2 is not the problem of sin. This is really radically important. I was always taught the way to evangelize and to give the gospel is, the opening gambit is you're a sinner, you're going to hell. All words to that effect. However, that's the problem statement. Now, do you remember what Bonhoeffer said? We become Band-Aid people. We're at the edges of life. We're not at the core of life if that's our opening gambit. So what does he do? He does exactly what Athanasius do. It's not our problem he talks about. It's God's problem. God created the universe, and he created it for a purpose, and he put humanity in to as the agents of that, and it got screwed up. So Athanasius's great book on the incarnation, which in many ways, so Athanasius's great chapter, you get it in the heading, is The Divine Dilemma and its solution in the incarnation. It's not our problem, it's God's problem. That's what Athanasius is all about. He's in the mind of God, in the heart of God, having created humanity to govern the cosmos, and it got screwed up. That's the problem. Our sin's just, it's the detail about how it happened. So what's God going to do? Athanasius says, what's God going to do? If he does anything, if he can't solve this, he's shown his purposes were, he's limited. He can be diverted from his purposes. So it's God's dilemma, not ours. And this is where he's beginning here, because God set a ruler, which is where he goes to. And we won't go into this. There's just so tremendous to go into these prophecies he's quoting from the Old Testament. But in a way, the last of the prophecies intimates the problem, which is that God's eternal, but his creation's going to perish. Like, you can read that as a promise, but from God's point of view, what's the point of falling in love with a dying princess? You know, his bride's dying. The object of his affection is dying. What comfort is it for God for the universe to be wrapped up like a garment and perish? This is the divine dilemma, because it can't corroborate, it can't reciprocate. So God's problem is that he doesn't have a partnership with eternally alive creation. That's kind of implied in the end there. And that's why verse 14 amplifies that actually, you know, we are the ones who are in play here. Now, in chapter 2, he moves into that very fully by saying the incredibly important verse 5. It is not to angels. It is not to angels he has subjected the world to come, of which we have been speaking. So his whole view is there's a kingdom, there's a created order, a world to come, and angels aren't going to rule it. Never meant to rule it. Don't have the capacity to rule it. They're not bright enough to rule it. I'm going to get to a point when I get onto creativity. I believe Satan cannot invent a new thing. I believe angels cannot imagine a new thing. Only God and us can do that. We have faculties that are so unique they are not shared with anyone. We're the only ones made in the image of God. It's not like we're like 16 ranks down on all the divine. And that's why, you know, I mean, as a young Christian, everyone was kind of, if I could show you something supernatural, would that take your breath away? I had a vision. I saw a demon. I'm praying against Satan. You think, oh, this is heavy stuff. This is a really important stuff. Don't bore me. I mean, I don't care. That's child's play. I think, you know, that's genius. That's the image of God. Me having a new thought is the wonder and the power. And that's exactly where Athanasius goes. Our capacity to reason. Our capacity to think. So that's going to make us rulers. But Psalm 8, so he goes in this incredible use of Psalm 8. What is man that you're mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under his feet. But we do not see everything under his feet. This is the incredibly important verse that he is clearly saying humanity in practice is not ruling. Stuff crumbles in our hands. We're mortal, we lose faculty. It's not that we've lost the creative instinct. It sort of feels to me like if people tell me if you have your leg amputated, you still think it's there, right? We want to create. And we want to control. It's just such an instinct. And we want to do it in eternal ways. You must understand this is why Shakespeare said writing is immortal. What bounds me in mortality is time and space, isn't it? Time and space. What do I do when I write? I smash time. We're still We're talking about Shakespeare tonight. We're reading his words. He died a long time ago. Sorry. Well, we should throw his book away. No. I want to read it. So he's smashed by the power of language. He's become semi-immortal. And so we've got this incredible drive to control everything. This meeting I had here tonight on big data is just like spooky scary. We're getting closer to God. What if I could control all the data in the universe? There's some great big project. I don't know what it was, SKA. They're just going to sort of smash the entire internet together. And they're like, we're trying to be God. We can get more bits of the pieces together. And that's our instinct. It's still with us. Nothing wrong with it. The Christian view that says, oh, this is, you know, arrogance, ego, the market. No, it's wrong. Rubbish, it's wrong. It's the God-given instinct to rule, to create, to develop. But it'll always be frustrated. That's what he's saying, because we die. And not just we die, but we don't have the faculties. We're morally bankrupt. So that's where his butt comes from. We're not seeing the rule. So Psalm 8's a joke. That's what he's essentially saying. Psalm 8 isn't true. But then he has the epic, but we see Jesus. Psalm 8 is true in Jesus. He's not saying Jesus is the Son of God. He's saying Jesus has now defined humanity and secured the reality of all we're saying in Psalm 8 for humanity. Therefore, Jesus is not ashamed to call them my brethren. Does that make sense? And there's a wonderful diagram I used to draw, which I didn't put in my notes, but it's kind of like, sort of goes like this. I don't know, it might have a terrible mechanical metaphor like a drive shaft or something, but the mistake a lot of us make is that we human beings kind of imagine our relationship to God the Father, and that's actually imprecise. The New Testament said we are locked into Jesus as his brothers, and thus we inherit all of his relationship with the Father. And that's the image that he's got here by being brethren. So in that enormous sweep of argument, that's why he finishes saying, so therefore he implores them. He hasn't used religion. He hasn't used customs. He's just got such a big picture that sacrificial systems and Jewish customs and temples are just out of play here. He's gone right back to the beginning of creation. He didn't identify it as 10 billion years and the Big Bang and all that, but it wouldn't have freaked him in the... I think he'd be far less surprised than that than we are. Far less surprised. That's his scope. And Jesus has put us there and done everything to secure. So that's the textual, theological analysis of chapters 1 and 2. Does that make sense?
I'm thinking it's not just an instinct either. In Genesis, we're given a license.
Well, yes, it's a mandate and a commandment. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so with that kind of theological foundation, what I want to do in the second, in the finishing section of this is almost retell that story now in thoroughly, apparently non-religious terms, but to me, the terms in which I think. And it's just a trajectory. This is a long conversation I'm having with a lot of people who are trying to do the same thing. You know, the reframe stuff out of Regent is trying to do the same thing. But if it's right, and I know Rick Watts was getting this when we're talking with Rick, like our whole curriculum's obsolete. See, we go to Bible college, and what do I teach you to do if you go to Bible college? I teach you to, read the scripture and preach and pray and be a pastor. They're all kind of, they could be called religious stuff. I don't teach you anything about what I've just said. There's no so what about it. And if I did open the space, which thankfully some places are doing now, to say, actually, the domain of our activity is the entire cosmos and the entire earth, I don't give you any tools to do anything with it. Accept a theological license to say it's okay. So this is the question. Well, what would we do if we could, with this worldview, participate in a broader arena? What should be the appropriate gospel-inspired, non-religious language to participate in this broader life? And that's what Bonhoeffer was struggling for. We all are. Here's my go at it, latest go at it tonight, because I've tried it before. So let's go back to Bonhoeffer's problem. You remember that his problem was metaphysics. He said that's actually part of the problem, which is the kind of sacred-secular split, where the world of matter is profane and visible, but the sacred is up there. We add God as reality to reality, and interiority, the public-private split, which limits God to the boundaries of human experience. And so God gets put into a private place, and where we have the sacred and metaphysical can participate in the private, but the public arena we don't have much to say for. And there's no, you know, and of course now that when Christians try to participate in the public arena, it's just embarrassing. Like, you know, dear old Fred, I love him, but Fred and I, like, oh, I just like cringe. Oh, please. You know, like it's where the moral policeman of the universe and where, you know, let's get rid. I can remember when I was a teacher at Barker, you know, and there's a lovely guy on the council, you're a lovely man, he's a reverend, you know, and he wasn't the smartest tool in the shed. And I was head of English, and his whole point is he wanted to ban Catcher in the Rye, you know. Like, that's the Christian view, let's ban Catcher in the Rye. I'm thinking, oh, you know, it's a great book, I love it, what the hell are you talking about? It's just so embarrassing. I mean, so what do we do? Anyway, that's our, so.
I think we're getting a little bit better in the public sphere.
I think what's happening is we're opening it up as a legitimate space to play, but I don't think we have the tools and the frameworks. I don't know anyone who does yet. I think, yeah, that's it. And my view is the people who will answer that question are not in Bible colleges and academies. They are out in the world doing it. They're what I call reflective practitioners. So, you know, believers like us who might be all sorts of things in the world with this picture who actually work it out in practice and can create a theory of it. That bottom quote's really important, that the religious man searches furiously to reserve a place for God, and today the place is at the boundaries. So how do we get it? How could we use what we've said to say we're at the boundaries? We're not at the boundaries. So in the new landscape, I would say we have a view of reality to offer the world. It's not metaphysics. It's actually a view of reality, which actually, I think, says this cloudy bubble is not sacred, but it's meaning, like life. The big question is, does life have meaning? Is there a cloudy bubble in life? Everyone is worried about that. I was going to quote, but I won't tonight because it's too long, but Wordsworth's great poem on intimations of immortality. Like, does my life matter? Am I just a bunch of chemicals? Is the whole thing just some game? I mean, T.S. Eliot, one of his great poems, he ends the poem with some of my favourite of all poem lines. He looks at London, a London urban landscape at night. There's nothing noble about it. He's not on a top of Mount Everest. He's not looking at a raging surf. He's looking at a grotty street in the back of London and people hurrying home at night. And he says, I am moved, when he finishes, he says, I'm moved by fancies that crowd around these images and cling. The notion of some infinitely gentle, infinitely suffering thing. The spirit. Is there a spirit in these people? Is there an infinitely gentle, infinitely suffering thing everywhere? Everywhere. Is life holy? And then he kind of stops and moves to give it up. No, the world's revolved like ancient women gathering fuel in vacant lots. It's a joke. It's as meaningful as little old ladies walking round and round in circles gathering fuel in ancient lots. That's the world. So we have something to say about that in terms of it's a belief that's very important. I think the view of viewing everything as a created order and an expression of God is incredibly liberating. And not many people get it, to be blunt with you. I mean, every Christian says, yeah, God created stuff, but I'm talking about a penetrating view of creation that unlocks wonder everywhere. So my favourite example of it is Moses and the burning bush. There's a bunch of twigs, and suddenly this bunch of twigs starts to shine. And I view it, Ron, as the nuclear energy actually coming out of it. And everything's a burning bush. Everything's a burning bush. And until we see the burning bush in everything, we're not seeing it as it really is. And by that, I don't just mean nature. I mean human condition. I mean social systems. Everything's a burning bush. There's the seam of glory in it. And so So seeing that is very, very pertinent and powerful. A human-centered view of creation is enormously important, by which I mean that the gospel, by putting us human beings at the centre, is essentially saying, this should be my bias. I should take this everywhere, in everywhere I go, as my worldview, that all created constructs have to be human-centred. This becomes very practical if you work in corporate life like I do. It actually becomes a battleground. So as an example, I just talked about, let's just be practical. So today I'm facilitating some of the leaders in Australia, of whom we're a participant in big data. The traditional approaches in big data is the machine thinks. It's kind of a spooky world. It's a spooky world because, and you know, the kind of crunch point was when IBM built a machine that beat Boris, whatever his name, as a chess, Big Blue. Like, so can machines think? So you're in the middle of this, can machines think? Now, you know, so I have a view which I proudly put forward that machines are very useful, but humans are the dominant. You cannot have a non-humanistic thinking system, including big data. So I put that view forward. It's what I believe, but I also think it's smarter. And if you really want to create a big data engine that works, it's got to be human-centered. And these guys are all the technical people from, you know, Cisco and Play. They all agree with me. Wow, that's fantastic. Yes, it's got to be human-centered. I'm not saying I'm a Christian, excuse me, let me read you Genesis 1, but I'm making a case that I actually think is right theologically correct, and it's going to be smarter. And we're going to build, if we do, a better big data engine than almost anyone else because it's smart. It's built on a human-centered view of reality. So that's just one example that could just go on, and that's actually a battleground. Now, did anyone hear Peter Harrison's talk on the Richard Johnson lectures? Peter's fantastic. He's actually a kind of philosopher of history, but it was on science versus faith, and he was actually exploring the question of, is there an antagonism between science and faith from many angles. One angle was, well, do scientists believe in God or not? Is it true that the more scientific I am, the less I believe in God? So he got into the data between the sciences. A very interesting chart. So imagine on the left-hand side I have engineers and physicists and mathematicians. They believe in God a lot. The ones who don't believe in God, still under the sciences, are the social scientists, psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists. They're the fuzzy ones. And he made a very good point, because actually, if I go to physics and engineering, there is no fundamental disagreement, but here we have an anthropological clash. Who is a human being? And we do disagree here. So it's little wonder this is more of a battleground. So, you know, that's I think that's another area. In terms of, I crystallize all of this with what I call Lorenzo's problem. My dear friend in Milan, who we'll go to see in a little while. You could pray for Lorenzo. He's a wonderful Italian scallywag. He's our co-grandparent, about 10 years older than me. Just your image of the Italian man, you know, whatever, he'll fit it, you know. And like a lot of Italian men, he hates the church, you know, saw abuse. So he's an atheist now. And he's chucked the baby out with the bathwater. But when we begin to meet with him, he doesn't speak English much at all. And for whatever reason, they asked us to say grace. So I just say grace at the table. Thanks, Lord. And this made a huge impact on him. He's talking to God like God's real. And so now we have this conversation. He just latches onto me. And the last time was actually driving us to the train in Milan. The whole time he's firing an end. It was translating, because it's hard to actually, even if you're good at Italian, it's hard to translate while they're talking. She felt the anointing of the Holy Spirit because she was translating while he's talking. And then I wrote a letter back, which you know, to him, which we should stick on the website, which I felt a lot of anointing for, use Roy Williams' book. But he was very astute, and I formed a different, I think we've got it all wrong with the gospel. I think most people want to believe, but we think most people don't want to believe. So my goal, which I'd love to write if I have time, someone could do it, I might get try and get Roy Williams to do it, it's the airport book, which is Faith, a User's Guide. Faith, a Handbook. Like, I'm assuming you want to believe, but you've got all these blockers. And that's what he's like. He's desperate to believe. I envy you. I wish I'd like you, Tony. But, so rather than, you know, I'm totally your enemy, it's actually where my all made in the image of God, I'd love to have what you've got, but I can't. I think there are, you know, the far more people are in that boat than we think. But if we frame the message antagonistically, because they just get, you know, more reasons not to believe. So when I got into Lorenzo's head, it was very interesting to see where his doubt came from, because I could get it. And his doubt, essentially, it was not over religion, it was over the cosmos. It essentially boiled down to this: it's a question of volume. It's so big, I'm so small, you tell me how I'm significant. He got what we're talking about in Hebrews 2. You're telling me Jesus is the Son of God, you're kind of telling me that I'm kind of up there with him, ruling the universe. He doesn't know this, but he says, I'm actually an insignificant nothing. I've just got this short life, I'll be gone. And I look out to the stars and they're so vast and huge. How am I meaningful in that space? That was what he was saying. He was right on the money. For me to talk to him about Jesus is implying mankind is somehow or other special. But how can I be? You know, 2 meters tall. How does that measure against the volume of eternity? So we have something very important to say there. And that's where I haven't got time to get into it, but there's a magnificent article, which is, this is the world I play in, which is the imagination. The article's called, Every Man with a Blue Guitar, Imagination, Creativity and Language. Because if we put forward the proposition that we are designers of the universe, then what I would say is the core task of humanity is imagination, not obedience. Or else, if you want me to put it in terms that don't offend people, the great obedience is to be imaginative. The great obedience is to be imaginative. God is bored by anything else. He's angered. He's frustrated. He did not put us here to comply with him. He put us here to develop the place. So, I'm coming to this. Christians should be the greatest advocates for reform, for development in whatever sphere they play of anyone else. It's obvious, isn't it? If you're going to believe Genesis 1, like we said, that's got to be it. And we've got to have strong arguments for it. This is, you know, I think I've told the story before. The guy who in many people's minds began atheism was Feuerbach. Ludwig Feuerbach. You read Feuerbach's life, Germany, early 19th century. Studied theology, going to become a minister. What turned him off? Well, at that time, Germany was an economic basket case. They were poverty-stricken. They were locked into a medieval landlord-dominated system. Landed gentry, you know, these little petty princes ran everything. There was no enterprise. And there was mass unemployment, including amongst ministers, so he had no job. And guess where the church lined up? On the side of the princes. Anti-reformists. You know, if the church had been a activist sort of reformist organisation, he would have behaved very differently. So we need a view of our power of leverage. Now, I can't go there tonight because we'll be here for a lot longer and we're all interested but tired at this point. But there are some models on the board which are just, to me, breathtaking. There's a model of anthropology and the power of language. You know, Hebrews 1 begins with Jesus is the Logos. Now, I cannot develop this. If you wanted to read this article, it develops it. But the views of language fit into, on the one hand, the behaviorist view of language, which is it's just a copycat system. Our mind's a blotting paper. We just get this codifying system. People on the right are my people. Hang on. Language is a mystery of unimaginable proportions. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite definitions of language is language unitizes reality. What's to stop me perceiving the world in atomistic terms? Why do I look at you, Nikki, and see a person rather than a billion pixels. There's no reason why, because you are also a billion pixels or multi-million, whatever they are, molecules. Why don't I see you like that? What makes me see a tree and say a tree's a tree? This is where linguistic theory, the great battleground is. What, by what power? And this, by the way, mesmerized Jonathan Edwards against Hume and Locke. By what power do I see forms? And I tell people all the time in my, the enormous, this gets into creativity. So, you know, I proudly lead the most creative strategic firm in Australia. We really are. No one else plays the game we do. Everyone's too scared to, because you can analyse costs out, but how do you build new revenue streams? You've got to have a structured method of invention, which is what we've codified. So we have a structured method of invention. Now, the breakthrough is this, that all these poor analysts, scientific method people, turn everything into a process. Steps one, step two, it's actually very funny to look at. I won't mention the name of the firms because they're all so famous, but I love looking at their kind of invention methodologies where they try and copy it, like Tuesday afternoon, PM, generate ideas. Wednesday morning, prioritise ideas. Hang on, what if the ideas don't want to come on Tuesday afternoon? I mean, let's get real here. And they said, oh, we did it, Tony, and it didn't work. I'm like, bah. Well, if I were to back right up, you have a pathetic view of human cognition, because we do not think in processes. The big mistake that computer scientists make, including Herb Simon, whom I agree a lot with. If I chart left-right process like a decision tree, it looks like it, but I don't think that way. Cognitive scientists don't think that. I mean, Polanyi's, but it's more like emergence. So what we do is make it simple. It's that process called the thinking wave, which people love. It's actually so powerful. The thinking wave, it moves from left to right, but it has a vertical axis in it as well. You see that? So the vertical axis is abstraction. I don't just move from left to right. I'm taking experience and I'm abstracting it. And the higher I abstract it, the more brilliant my solution becomes. It's the human capacity for model making. Does this make sense for people? And now the capacity for model making, nobody can explain why, because as I go up, I don't just add the parts together. This is what systems theory says. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I just can't get like a billion bits of stuff and put them together and get a Boeing 777. It doesn't work. They call that emergent property. So what I tell people, and this is like, you know, this is, I suppose, part of the seamlessness of my life, when I'm going through this with my clients, everyone, I say, so as you go up, there's a big question, which is, what do you do when you hit the top? And how high can you go? And who's taking us up there? I said, you can't get away from it. This is a theological question. Because God's at the top. That's what Plato said. Plato said God's at the top, and we're at the bottom. So you just cannot get into imaginative processes without tripping right over God everywhere. Does that make sense? And you've got a worldview or you haven't got a worldview. And what I've seen is the stupidity of a worldview that denies mystery. Doesn't work, fails, it's a joke. The words that are used in imagination, including by people like Steve Jobs, are words like faith, gut instinct, mystery. These are metaphysical words and they're real. If you know how big Apple is, anyone know how big Apple is? You know that Apple is approaching the size of Australia's economy. It's up to two-thirds of our GDP. Capital value. He didn't build that on the left to right. He built that on the mystery intuition. So what we're saying is that human beings have incredible leveraging power, and it's language that leverages us. Does that make sense to you? So yes, I might look at myself through one lens as very small, but in another lens, I can actually think about the entire universe. So perhaps I'm as big as the universe. Perhaps the scale of volume's wrong versus the scale of intimacy. Does this make sense? So there's a very strong anthropology here as to just how big we are. And the gap, for many people, the gap between us and God is not sin, it's volume. It's not metaphysics, it's physics. And so, and that, I believe, is an effect of the fall, the sin, is that there's a big gap between me and God on the mortality, physicality level. So, and for Lorenzo, that's real. He doesn't say, Tony, I'm worried about my sins. He says, Tony, I'm worried I'm so small. all the data tells me I'm really small. And you're talking about a message that says I'm really big and I can't fit it into my framework. So an anthropology of scale is important. I don't think anyone kind of said it better than Emily Dickinson. The brain is wider than the sky. For, put them side by side, the one, the other, will contain with ease, and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them, blue to blue, the one, the other, will absorb, as sponges, buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God. For heft them, pound by pound, and they will differ, if they do, as syllable from sound. It's worth another reading, obviously, but it's a very profound point. The brain is actually wider than the sky because the brain can think about the sky. The sky can't think about the brain. So the brain contains the sky and so on. And therefore the brain, perhaps it's the weight of God. And if I were to compare the brain and God, it's not big, small, it's just syllable to sound. God's the sound, we're the syllable. It's not a difference in scale. It's a difference in expression.
To me. Lorenzo needs a different perspective.
He needs a different perspective. And so do we. Yeah, I think we've all got to keep persuading ourselves on this because this is so kind of counterintuitive. Finishing off, that's kind of the worldview that certainly animates my life. And, you know, is this Christian? Is this... I don't know, but it's the worldview that I hold. And you can see why it's, you know, if I'm in a workshop on big data, Hebrews 1 is very close to my own mind. I'm just like, I can't draw it.
Tony, quick question. Are your question marks under anthropology on the right side? You're looking for a word to contrast with behaviour.
Yeah, it's just like a group of people who disagree. They're not really a school, but he quotes Noam Chomsky, and a biologist called Sennett, but there's plenty of other people who are on the right who essentially, they're in a minority, but they're, to me, far more profound than the behaviourist schools. And Lisa, you could probably say much more about that than any of us could, I think, in psych. But to humanise, so that's why the question marks. Let me finish on the new activity of the gospel. So, you know, what we said is there's this private-public space. So if you had this new view of reality, you had this new worldview of reality, what activities would we be involved in with that, with such a view of reality? So, and I think it kind of, these are the views that are important to me. So the field of design in the 20th and 21st century to me is front and centre. That's why I love it, because when we design, we shift reality. And what I tell people is the first object of design is your own life. That's your first object of design. So everything's an object of design to me. A family is, a conversation is. And that's actually the paradigm I think would be much better taught in churches and theological colleges everywhere. Rather than viewing life as an examination to get right or wrong, view it as a canvas where I paint a portrait. View it as a story that I'm on earth to write, and only I can write that story. There are God-given tools I've got by way of my circumstances, by way of my situation, but I'm here to write a story, and I'm to write a story in professionally, I'm write a story in my family, even in small situations. How do I craft them? Because what we're told, if you remember John Walton's fantastic stuff, and I hadn't had time to go into this, is God is interested in order. One thing I wanted to read tonight, which I just forgot in my rush to bring here, was a card a graphic designer wrote to me when I spoke in Vancouver to 3,000 people in the Industrial Design Association of America. And I finished it with Genesis 1, verse 2, which I said was, to me, the most archetypal description of the creative process. Essentially, chaos into order. It's in us all. So that's a God-given instinct, and I would be taking that much more seriously everywhere. I think we have a sense of the telos that no one else does, which I would call the New Jerusalem. One of the critical things for me in the work I do, and I can only use that as an example, is hopelessness. I struggle with it. We all need hope. and lots of us struggle with hope. So I won't go, and we have a major client whom you'd all know, so I won't mention it, but they're kind of going down the tube because all the revenue streams are crashing, and we're helping them try and invent new revenue streams. So I had a conversation with the most creative guy in the company. He's fantastic. And we went through this great idea. We've got a great idea. We think it's a $1 billion idea. We're pretty good about it. He says, but the only other point, Tony, is are you right? Am I a Lone Ranger? He said, look, off the record, this is such a frustrating place to work. Like, it is so fragmented. They won't invest in change. And fundamentally, I'm cynical that we'll ever, no matter how good our idea is, get it happening. Now, does anyone identify with that? So, you know, in that circumstance, we've really got a choice. Do we hope, you know, can we authentically tell people it can be better? Or is it actually eternal frustration? Now, I struggle with that in my life because there's no exercise we've ever done that's been 100% successful. Well, the New Jerusalem tells me that God's in the game. He wants to personalize the universe, and the hope we all have to build the New Jerusalem is his hope. And it might not be, it won't ever be fulfilled here, but it will be in the New Jerusalem. So I really believe that all the efforts of reform will actually have their culmination. And this gives me hope as a reason to keep doing it. The other point about the New Jerusalem is, we again won't go in here, but goes back to the city metaphor. God is very interested in social systems, centrally interested in social. It's actually his main interest. His main object of design is social systems. It's not actually the wind and the sea and the cliffs and the mountains. It's social systems. So the Bible begins with a garden but ends with a city. And so all of us are involved in social systems. And that's Trinitarian. They're families, there's friendships, there's churches, there's clubs. And social systems, we all know that. They are, you know, pathologically fragmented. There's disharmony, there's lack of understanding. So, you know, and that could go down to rifts in families, but just stuff not working. And the question is, you know, a long time ago, I stopped viewing the problem as sin. It just doesn't help me to diagnose a family argument on the sin register. Like, okay, we've just a situation in a business. You know, let's now look at it. Who's the most guilty? We could do a spreadsheet of guilt and get some kind of categorization factor to find out where the sin lies that's led to this. My favourite institution in the world is ripping itself apart at the moment. Could diagnose it as sin. I just think I prefer to diagnose it as this sense of frustration, incompetence, incapability. It's the death system. We're not good at stuff. You know, we've got limited capacity. So therefore, but God is very interested in harmonious, productive, beautiful, generative, working social systems. He always is. And anything we can do to contribute to that is great. Does that make sense? So collaboration is a theological word. It's a Trinitarian word. The big data thing today was all about the problem we've got in Australia. The problem we've got in Australia, we need innovation, but Australia is among the worst in the OECD at commercialisation. Very good at input research, shocking at commercialisation. One of the reasons is we're extremely siloed in our university departments. Nobody talks to anyone else, and we're siloed between town and gown. You go to the US, where I'm a visiting professor at two universities on Carnegie Mellon, had 50 programs that were sponsored by industry and the university, and it worked. Australia doesn't do that. So how do I view that theologically? It's easy. God loves collaboration. He'll bless any system that collaborates. Just a rule. It's a New Jerusalem rule. So when Jesus says that blessed are the peacemakers, he's not just saying, you know, pour oil. He's smart people who make stuff knit together. I think I would reframe private and public as the battle between the individual and the state. How do I create social systems that accommodate individual creativity? We're all involved in that. And how do I get diversity linked with unity? These are huge issues that the whole worldview we're involved in says we can play a role in. So that leads to my picture of the private public. I rename it, God is interested in a personal universe or a personalized universe. I actually think God wants to personalize the entire universe, beginning with the earth. That's my present image of the new kingdom, is he wants to personalize the whole created order. So there are trajectories, I think, in terms of activities we should be involved in that would lead me into skills and tools and approaches. Does that make any sense to anyone, or am I just talking to myself here? So that's I think that's where I will end it, but I'm going to end it by reading out a quote from a friend of mine. A dear friend, Richard Buchanan. So Richard is the, in my view and the view of many others, the most profound thinker on design in the world. So he was the professor of design at Carnegie Mellon. He's now the he's been headhunted by a business school, and he's the head of strategy and innovation at the Weatherhead Business School University, Case Western University in Cleveland. So he's part of the at the vanguard of bringing creativity to business. Nobody's influenced me intellectually as much as Richard. Well, the big influences of my life kind of intellectually would probably be Mark Strom and Richard, theologically, Richard Buchanan. Richard and I have lovely talks about the gospel. Richard has said some of the most profound things to me anyone said to me about my faith, but he says he's coy about where he stands, except he did say to me, when he invited me to be the chair of design at Carnegie Mellon, we spent a long time together, he said to me, "Well, damn it, my mother would be proud. She'd be happy. I thought I'd got rid of Christianity, and then this guy from the Antipodes turns up." So there's something going on in his head. But he told me, "Tony," he said, "you're dangerous." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, because you're dangerous in the world of Christianity." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because it polarizes to two sides. Either the kind of fundamentalist strong-arm side or the kind of charismatic existential side. And you're in the middle and you don't believe either. You believe faith is a work of art and you're dangerous to both sides." I thought that's very profound. I had to give a lecture. I had to give a lecture, public lecture, as part of this chair I had. I was the Nirenberg Chair of Design. Just a lovely, important phrase. It is actually an important position. It was 1995. So I was getting it ready. He said, "Well, Tony, I only have one request of you in what you're going to talk about." He said, "I want you to talk about your faith and how it's impacted you." Quote, "I have no time for coyness in these matters. I have no time for coyness in these matters." He knew my faith structured everything I did, and he wanted me to talk about it. So he, on his side, is saying, "I want a seamless world here. You know, you can't, don't compartmentalise on me." So he wrote a phenomenal article, which I'm just going to quote a bit of, called Rhetoric, Humanism and Design. It's because actually the reason that Richard is so powerful is his PhD's in philosophy from the University of Chicago under Richard McKeon, who's the most epic philosopher of the 20th century, a gargantuan intellect who framed Chicago University. But he's looking for, in the world of design and fabrication and so on, where do we get meaning? And he had various answers. But the last one's called Spiritual Life, Hellenism and Hebraicism in Design. I'll just read a bit of it to get this sense. You won't understand it all, but I'll give you a copy. "There is a persistent thread of spirituality in 20th century art and design, which has never found an adequately articulate voice in modern design theory. This is disappointing, because the widespread discontent with the fruits of science, technology, and business cannot be easily dismissed. Judged by the ideals of Western and Eastern cultures, the obsessive materialism, injustice, warfare, environmental degradation, and inhumanity of the past century of progress is a cruel denial of something fundamental in the human spirit, a betrayal of reason and conscience, of right thinking and right acting. Ironically, the two great theories of designing Western culture one embedded in Hellenism, the other in Hebraicism, have exerted little explicit influence on the development of design thinking in the period when design is most widely discussed. Yet traces of these theories emerge occasionally as a reminder of a resource that remains available to illuminate the work of those designers who are not content with pragmatic design and insist that design has a more important role to play in promoting human well-being. And on it goes. Pretty intriguing, isn't it? The Jews and the Greeks, and we need to recover the divinity in design. I won't read out any more, but just as an example of where this debate has gone, one other place it went, which was illuminating and of interest to me, is Edmund Phelps. Edmund Phelps is a Nobel laureate in economics, won the Nobel Prize in economics. He wrote it because of a book he wrote called Mass Flourishing. Mass Flourishing asked the question, where did the prosperity of the Western world come from? He first makes the case that beginning early 19th century, prosperity of an hitherto unexperienced scale occurred. He measures it by gross GDP and average incomes. And he said the whole previous era, including the mercantile era, 1500s, 1400s through to 1700s, 1800s, did not change GDP, did not improve average incomes. Just a few people got rich who owned like the East India trade. It didn't make any difference. Beginning of the 19th century, 10 countries in the world, not the same order, broke the mold and did something that was unprecedented in human history. GDP tripled, average incomes tripled in just a matter of a decade or two. Question, what happened? Something happened, what happened? That's his question. That's what the book's about. Interestingly, he dismisses technology and science as the answer. Historically and in economic theory, he dismisses it as the root cause of that change. The root cause of the change, he said, was the imagination, the creation of what he called the imaginarium, which is when pretty ordinary people began to want to solve problems for customers and create new markets on a mass scale, never seen before. That's his argument. Very interesting book. How that, you know, lifted poverty and created, you know, well-being. And his argument, most of it was below the radar. You know, some cobbler got an idea of making new styles and ended up employing 100 people and having thousands. You know, we don't know about that, but that's what was happening. So that's interesting. But what was more interesting was that I stumbled across a debate. He wrote an article in First Things. You know, everyone heard of that magazine, First Things? Quite a famous American magazine. The Catholics run it, but it's the most significant religious philosophy magazine in possibly the world, but certainly the US. Really interesting stuff. He wrote an article in it. And the article was The Morality of the Marketplace, or Morality and the Marketplace. And his argument was relatively simple. He said most people see that marketplaces are immoral. That's the most common distinction. You know, the market is a jungle, tramples on the poor, capitalism, you know, they're seen as polarities, and ethics is almost a critique of markets. You know, he puts forward that commonplace. Then he says, actually, my view is the opposite, that markets actually are a mechanism to allow human beings to be fully human and play and release and design themselves. And no other social system we've invented lets us do that because it releases. He's on the verge of saying the image of God, but he doesn't use any religious language whatsoever. So, and there was some debate in the letters around whether he was right or not, but it's very interesting, almost the theology of the marketplace. So with that, I will stop, but having begun in a broad sweep tonight from Hebrews chapter 1 and 2, I've tried to make the case that there's a high ground charted in chapter 1 and 2 for which it's very easy to see a trajectory through into a way of imagining, you know, what it would look like to have a religionless faith where we take the grand themes of that and essentially virally have a different worldview of infecting life. So that's it.